In the days that followed, as his body accustomed itself to dizziness and retching, he dreamt up good reasons to freeze to death. Across the timber he scratched out good reasons to stay alive. How craven he felt, for his children were not among them. Somewhere on the march he had passed through a vale. Now he was working in some other world, where his children did not exist, except as figments of his imagination. Nothing as perfect as Caspar, his firstborn, his son, could exist in a world which permitted this system of Katorga to exist. Out here there was but one reason to stay alive, to spite that piece of you, that powerful piece whose influence grew day on day, which wanted nothing more than to lie down in the snow and wait for the end. Kathy, can you be brave? The world morphed around Kathy again, and the only thing that stopped her from panicking was looking back to see Papa Jack still there, turning the crank handle of the toy that had spirited all of this into being. When the world reappeared, she was out in the woods, and around her the men in shackles were working in teams to drag timber into the thawed river and send them sailing downstream.
"I have to go now," said Jacobs, his hand slipping out of hers.
"Go."
"I'm sorry," he said, "but remember, all of this happened in the very long-" Jacobs did not finish the sentence, for at that moment two figures appeared from behind, and wresting him off his feet, dragged him into the trees. Kathy shrieked his name, hurried after. The world turned to mist around her, and then she was in the trees, Jacobs pinned on the floor with Ursa Major and Ursa Minor above him. She shrieked again, but her voice could not be heard. Not in this world that was nothing but memory given form.
"We know what you are," Ursa Major was bawling. "We know what you do. Trading for supplies with those little stick soldiers of yours. Well, who made them currency? We're the only currency there is."
They had torn Jacob's coat off, made gashes in his shirt, when another cry came out of the trees, and there appeared Chichikov, his comrades Grigorian and Grisha at his side.
"Hands off the toy maker," Chichikov leered.
And when the Ursas only laughed, there was no second warning. Chichikov came forward, an axe in his hand, and the only thing that stopped blood being shed in the forest that day was the patrol who chanced across them, sending even the Ursas Major and Minor scattering into the trees. That night, Jakob's godman found himself lashed to a stump on the forest's edge, forced to face the night and all its howling demons. But he was not alone, for, his back still raw from the birch-rod lash, there was Chichikov, staked to a stump beside him, and there was Grisha, and there was Grigorian, all of them together. The night was vast. Sleep came, but the cold always woke them.
"Why?"
Jakobs breathed when he could stand the silence no more.
"I do that for me."
Beside him, Chichikov reached into his pocket and produced one of Jakob's soldiers, plundered from him many nights before.
"Have you any idea?"
he replied, his voice raw through the blisters.
"When I line up your soldiers, toy maker, I am a boy again. I am with my papa, and he's lining up soldiers too. I am in front of that fire in Petersburg where we used to live. Or I am in the gardens of Mars fighting with sticks. I'm not here. And..."
Kathy imagined him about to say, "I'm not me." But the sentiment was too much for a man like Chichikov. He hawked up phlegm, spat it into the snow.
"No, toy maker. They won't touch you. Not again. Not while we still live."
"And that is how," said Jacobs, "how I survived, and how I knew what toys truly are. I'd found a kind of... a magic, if you will. A way of reaching the soul of a man, because even men like Chichikov... they would spend their nights parading my toy soldiers up and down. You won't believe it now,
But a year into Akutoga, Ursa Minor himself pulled a toy soldier from the floorboards in our shack, and that night I saw him marching it up and down his palm as he stood guard. And I came to know there's a shared heritage in toys. Take any man and show him a hobby horse, and a little piece of him will be a boy again, desperate to put it between his legs and take a ride. If you're going to make a toy, you have to hold one truth as inviolable above all others. That once upon a time, all of us, no matter what we've grown up to do or who we've grown up to be, were little boys and girls, happy with nothing more than bouncing a ball against a wall. That's what I'd discovered in the East. I took something good from my Katorga, and it transformed my life. Jacobs reached out a hand and clasped Kathy. You must go now. But back to the Emporium. He looked sadly at his blistered, frost-bitten hands. I survived this, Kathy. I'll be seeing you soon. Behind Kathy, Papa Jack's hand froze on the crank handle, and as the toy stopped moving, so did the walls of the study reassert themselves. The wilderness of white faded, Papa Jack's ledgers returned to their shelves, and the cold that had worked in her body slowly ebbed away. The fur she had been wearing sloughed off her shoulders and vanished before it hit the ground. She heard the faint cries of Jacob's fellow prisoners growing fainter yet, and then it was gone. She turned around. Papa Jack sat slumped in his chair, his hands still on the crank handle, though it moved no more. He looked spent, his face as white as the hair that fell around it. Kathy went to him and, kneeling down, took his hand. Jacobs? She ventured. Papa Jack? He looked up. Didn't I tell you? He whispered, smiling sadly. It's not a story I'm fond of telling. You see now why I wanted you to know. This is not only my emporium. This is my life. I could no more throw out a mother and child than I could denounce a man like Ursa Minor. We all started in the same place, no matter where we end. That's how I've lived my life. That's how I'll die. I'm sorry, Jacobs. You mustn't be. The most terrible things can happen to a man, but he'll never lose himself if he remembers he was once a child. Gently he placed the toy back in its nest, and the chest scuttled into its hiding beneath the shelving. You must be tired, Kathy. Go. Get some rest. I'll have Mrs. Hornung bring you supplies. You might live in your Wendy house until the first frost of winter. By then we'll find you a place you might stay. She was still too disoriented to do anything but whisper her thanks. In that way she teetered back toward the door, certain that the books were opening and closing their pages to usher her on the way. As she reached the door, a thought struck her. Your advert, she said, the one that brought me here. It cried out to me. Are you lost? Are you afraid? I'm right, aren't I? It knew I needed help. That's why you sent it out into the world, to find people like me. Mrs. Hornung said that's what brought her here too, and when I looked at that advert, it was hovering, brighter than all the rest around it, and with that circle scribbled around it in ink. The advert that brought me here, it was one of your toys, wasn't it? One of your magics. Papa Jack had lifted his needle and thread, returned to the cross-stitched cadaver at his side, but his eyes came back to her now. The vacancy you came for, it was circled. Kathy nodded, uncertain what to feel. Your emporium, a place to hide from the world out there, the world where bad things happen. A home for people who need it, people like you, people like me. It found me, didn't it? He lay down his needle and thread. Kathy Ray, our advertisements are just advertisements. We need more shop hands every winter, even with those who come back year on year. There's nothing more to them than paper and ink. Couldn't be. She had felt so certain. But then... Whose newspaper was it, Kathy?
It belongs to my father.
And tell me, is your father the kind of man who reads that paper every night, looking at the situations vacant just in case?
He is.
And is he the kind of man who might know the right thing, even if he hasn't the words to say it? She thought suddenly of Jacob Godman, of rapists and murderers, slavers and saboteurs, all of them playing at toys, all of them children in the once upon a time.
He is, she whispered.
Then, Kathy, that advert you saw, that ink sketched around it. Perhaps that was the oldest kind of magic there is, the ordinary magic. A father who loves his daughter, telling her in the only way he knows how.
Love, Kathy said. Papa Jack, they tried to give her away.
She stressed the word, for that was what Martha was now. Not the idea of a child, not some imagining of the future, but a person, flesh and blood, with a heart separate from her own. Kathy, I brought you here to listen. But you have to hear it, too.
Papa Jack reached into his gown and opened his fist to reveal a pinecone figurine, one of the very same ones that Casper had shown her in the cabinet above. This was no soldier, but a girl's ballerina, crafted out of dead grass and bark. And yet, how lifelike its features were. How daintily it twirled en pointe on the tip of his finger.
Whenever you feel that way about your mother, about your father, I want you to take this and remember. There was your own first frost once. They'd have taken you to the step and showed it to you, sparkling in the night. And there was a first set of clothes, first birthday, a first present wrapped in ribbon that you couldn't quite unwrap yourself. Let it take you back there. You don't have to do anything. You never have to speak to them again if that's what you choose. Just so long as you remember.
Kathy took the ballerina, let it twirl around her palm, and thought she knew what Papa Jack meant. For on the edges of her vision she could see her old bedroom again. All of it reconstituted and only just out of reach. This was what had saved him, she remembered. This was the very same magic that had worked itself on Chichikov, Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, all of the rest. She looked at him now and tried to picture how his life had been, in those places at the ends of the earth, bartering for his life with enchanted creations of dead grass and bark. What was it Casper had said? A toy cannot save a life, but it can save a soul. How many souls had Jacob Godman saved, shackled in those frozen prison camps? Could it be real that the man sitting in front of her, the man she trusted entirely to cradle Martha in his hands, had spent so many years out there, among murderers and rapists and thieves, and turned them all into friends with the toys in his hands? She had seen so many magical things in the Emporium, but surely this was a magic too far. And yet every time she fingered the pinecone ballerina, she felt the same as those prisoners had done. Tiny flashes of halcyon days forked across her eyes, walking along the towpaths with her mother and father. "Hold Mummy's hand," she had shrieked delighted. "Hold Daddy's hand!" Or watching from the table as her father stole another slice of cake and rewarded her with a corner for not giving him away. Birthdays and Christmases, a ride on a steam train, the smell of her father covered in talc, or her mother's cheap perfume. These little things, and more, exploded in those pockets of recollection hidden behind the eyes, and all her bitterness faded away. She tried to picture how it might have been,
her father pacing the day away as she and her mother travelled up to Dover Court and back, prowling along the estuary sands with one hand clasping the other. The way his head had been buried as she came home that evening. Might that have been fear, not fury? In her mind's eye, she saw his fingers trembling to clasp his ink pen. London, he might have thought. Yes, you could disappear in a place like that. People go missing in London all of the time. Ordinary magic. All of the Emporium's wonders around her, all of the things Papa Jack's creations could do. But how much more powerful was this? Papa Jack, she said. Thank you. Outside, Casper was waiting. Casper, she said. There's something I have to do. Will you help me? Anything, Kathy. I'm your servant. Emile was still staring as they disappeared out to the gallery together, Sirius following obediently behind. Then, alone, he returned to his soldiers, began to lay each of them down in its red velvet case. Last of all came his Imperial Capitan, the original and most precious of the thousands he had made. Emile held him close, a much smaller boy trapped in a young man's body, until finally he felt foolish and tidied him away. In the end, it was weeks before she was strong enough to venture out. Casper stayed with her in the nights that came, his toy boxes sitting half-finished on his workshop floor. When Martha woke in the night, so did Casper. When Kathy needed somebody there to bring her tea or toast, or only to tell her that it was good to be tired, that being tired meant she was doing everything that she must, there was Casper, beating back his own exhaustion to sit at the foot of her bed. Those nights were long and empty, and when she was not nursing Martha or rocking her basket to try and get her to sleep, she asked Casper about his father and those things she had seen, and... Papa's life is very different to our own, he said. Sometimes I wonder if that's the reason, if that's why those things he can do seem so natural to him, but so strained to me and Emile. Mightn't it be, Kathy, that until you've seen the dark, you don't really know the light? I hope you never see that dark, Casper. Not for all the magic in the world. They made plans to leave at the start of Martha's 12th week. By then, the thought of returning to the world beyond the shop floor was not tantalizing, but disconcerting. I feel as if she's never really left the womb, Kathy said as, with Casper and Sirius, she crossed the shop floor and carried Martha out onto Iron Duke Mews. Summer was giving way to autumn, the sun growing too weak to properly dispel the London chill. At the bottom of Iron Duke Mews, the motor car Casper had hired was a boxy thing, gleaming black, and with wheels half as high as Kathy herself. Sirius was first aboard, sniffing at the leather seats with his cross-stitched nose. Only when he was satisfied did he scurry back to allow Kathy aboard. She lifted Martha in carefully, settled her basket on the seat and steeled herself. To run away by train and return in her personal carriage, what would they think of her when she appeared? Casper fancied himself a driver of estimable talent, but driving the carts he and Emile had created up and down the empty Emporium aisles each summer had taught him only recklessness and haste. Kathy had to bark at him more than once or grapple out with her arm to wrest him from the wheel as he joined the flow of traffic heading east along the river and out of the city. Beyond London, the roads lay empty and still. It was a revelation to see greenery again, that trees might sprout leaves in summer that were not curls of paper and corrugated card. Yet nothing was more revelatory than the smell that hit her as they came close to the sea. That smell, only salt, seaweed, perhaps even the barest hint of sewage, was intoxicating. She lifted Martha to breathe it in. Smells, she decided, were like the pine bark ballerina hidden safely in her pocket. They could make you feel 5, 6, 7 years old again.
Lee had not changed in the months she had been away. The streets were the same, the shop fronts, the boats basking across the mudflats like beached wrecks. She directed Casper quietly until at last they arrived at the street she had once lived. She had been gone mere months, had travelled only 30 miles, and yet a whole world existed between then and now. Are you certain of this, Kathy? She lifted Martha, wrapped her up in a shawl. She had not cried once, in spite of Casper's driving. But as Kathy stepped from the car, she strained against her shoulder, putting up a protest. Before Kathy could approach the first house, Casper called out, "Miss Ray, wait!" Before he went after her, he reached into the back of the carriage and produced a lady's leather purse, with ornamental clasps depicting butterflies in flight. In the middle of the road, beneath the brilliant reds of twilight, he presented it to Kathy. "It's for you. I've seen mothers staggering up and down our emporium aisles with such bulging bags, but not you. Not with this." It was difficult to tear herself away from his eyes, but when she unclasped the purse and looked inside, all she saw was blackness, rich and deep. She reached in, but her fingers could not find the bottom. There were all sorts of things that she wanted to say. She wanted to tell him thank you, for this purse, for bringing her so far away from his emporium, for the way he had knelt at her side and told her she was strong, that she could do it all as Martha came into the world. But instead she turned to face the old house and said, "You've never asked me who my baby's father is." The statement seemed to catch Casper off guard. "It isn't that I haven't wanted to ask, but you came to our emporium with your secrets. They're yours alone." "No," she whispered. The facade of the house seemed to glare down at her. "Not anymore." She found the courage to face them again. "Casper, I owe you the truth. I've been a coward. But the truth is, I haven't thought of Martha's father in so long. It already seems another life. He was a friend to me, for a little while. Nothing more." Casper's eyes twitched. "A little more, Miss Ray. I thought you'd stopped calling me that. Where is he now?" Kathy barely knew. "Gone. Off to some other family, some other future." "He didn't come looking, Casper. But I've already told you, it wasn't as if it was love." "Not love," said Casper, "but there are responsibilities." Kathy turned the word over. In the end, she supposed Daniel's responsibilities to his father had outweighed any responsibilities he had to a child who was barely an idea. But then there was Casper, the boy to whom ideas were everything. She turned and walked some distance, crossing the street to reach her house in 3 loping strides. When she looked back, Casper was still staring after her. "Casper, about that day we were in London, when you took me to the park, I wanted to. I want you to know that. And I might have, if only, how to say it without not hurting his feelings, because sometimes Casper Godman behaved as if he had no feelings to be hurt. Perhaps it was only without seeming foolish." In her heart she had wanted to, but it was her body. Her body had wanted different things. Things like rest, like food and water, like being able to sleep on a night without waking every second hour. People talked about the heart and the head being at war, but when you were pregnant, the body was separate, and the body ruled all. She lifted Martha to her shoulder, tightening the shawl around her. "I'm not pregnant now," she thought. "So what is it? What's stopping me? Propriety? Could that really have been it?" Because she had never once cared about being proper. She had spent the year, hadn't she, in Papa Jack's emporium instead of there, as her parents had planned. She strode back towards him. It was captivating how silent he was. He did not flinch, even as she lifted a hand to stroke the hair out of his eyes. Even as she rose onto her tiptoes, the baby sandwiched between them, and planted a kiss on the thin stubble that lined his cheek. "I knew you'd understand, Casper. If anyone could, it would be you." Then cooing at Martha, she walked into her house. It was cold out on the estuary. Casper took the motor car down to the sand and watched the tide glittering as the stars revealed themselves one by one. For a time he walked along the shale, listening to the waves. A pair of old lovers sat out on the rocks, holding each other as they gazed into the gas lamps on the other side of the water. Casper sat higher yet, the darkness solidifying all around. Without knowing he was doing it, he twisted a length of sun-baked seaweed into the skeleton of a sailing boat, and, giving that sailing boat wings, let it fly out into the blackness over the water. Those two old lovers, perhaps they had come here every night since they were children. Perhaps they would come here every night until, finally, one of them did not. And as he watched, he got to thinking. What if they had been born two streets distant? What if they had not been sent to the same schools, or if their parents had not met in the same beer hall, or walked the same routes through the same parks? What if she had not run away to his father's emporium, and he had not found her there? What if those boys had not crashed into his paper trees, and she had not taken shelter with him in the Wendy house at the bottom of the aisle? What then of life? An image, perfectly simple, seared onto the back of Casper Godman's eyes. He and Kathy, as old as these two, wrapped up together on the estuary's edge, wandering the aisles of their emporium, a threadbare Sirius still lolloping behind. What if she had never fallen pregnant by some other man and been driven into his world? The baby he had helped birth might never be his, but he could love her all the same, for that and everything else. Casper took the motor car back to the streets and stood outside Kathy's house. The silhouette show against the curtains was like one of his father's puppet theatres. He watched Kathy twirl. Figures stood and then sat down. He thought he heard laughter, and that was a beautiful thing. Until he remembered that only happiness might make her stay, here where she surely did not belong. After that, fear was like a seed sprouting shoots in his belly. He went to the door, but checked himself, went to the door again, and started at the voices within. A man his age hurried down the street, and the thought of him knocking at the door, for was this Kathy's estuary boy come back to be a father, made all the jealousy he had not known that he had flower. The door opened, and, framed by the light, there stood Kathy. Behind her hung figures Casper thought he would never see. Her mother, her father, a sister taller than Kathy with striking blonde hair. It was the sister who was holding Martha. Casper froze, allowing himself to breathe again only when Kathy took her daughter back into her arms. One by one she embraced the family around her. They had not come to claim her back, he saw. They had come to see her off. Her mother was stiff as Kathy held her, but her father gave in. His fingers teased the fluff of Martha's hair. Kathy joined him at the motor car and, in silence, allowed Casper to help her inside. Some way along the estuary, with the lights of Lee fading behind, he dared break the silence. "Are we going to be all right, Kathy?" When he said "we," he might have meant Kathy and Martha, or he might have meant all three of them. She nodded, but said not a word, for there were tears in her eyes, and she did not know what they were for, what she had lost or what she had gained. "You look like your daughter when you cry." "Casper,"
she snorted, and dried her eyes in the hem of her skirt. "Well, it's true." My father said that too. He said seeing her was like seeing me. "You might have stayed." Kathy nodded, trying to make sense of it all. After all of this, they would even have had me. A few lies here, a compromise there, we might have made it work. Into the silence that followed, Casper said, "There was a piece of me, a tiny corner that thought you would. That your life might be here, where it started. And while you were in there, that thought, it just kept on growing. I couldn't stop it. I think that must be what doubt feels like." "Kathy, I haven't thought it until now. But the thought of you not there in the Emporium, it..." "Hush, Casper," she said. "Take me home." The car drove on, back through the late summer night. The Emporium was silent when they returned. Emil and Mrs. Hornung had been busy replenishing some of the aisles, anticipating the first frost yet to come. Emil's soldiers looked resplendent on the shelves. In the Wendy house, Casper slid Martha into her crib, the only sound the suckling of her own thumb. Together they watched her squirm against her blankets, undisturbed by the world. "Will you go back?" Casper asked. He had crossed the room to hover in the Wendy house door, as if uncertain whether he should be in or out. It was such a nonsense to see him uncertain. It did not suit Casper Godman well, and the idea infuriated her. "Or they'll come here. My sister Lizzie, she may even apply for one of your situations vacant. She would be in good company, but..." Kathy rolled her eyes. She marched to meet him. "Casper, you fool. You keep asking yourself why I didn't leave. What you might be asking is why I stayed. Who I stayed for." Casper was still. Then he raised his hands to hold her. "You're saying..." "I'm saying I'm an Emporium girl through and through." Then he was kissing her, and his hands were in her hair, and hers were in his, while in the paper branches a pipe cleaner owl fluttered its wings, and the thin rustle of confetti snow began to fall down. Many years later. The home fire's burning. Papa Jack's Emporium, August to November, 1914. The sun had never touched the aisles of Papa Jack's Emporium, but this summer it was bleaching the London streets. The yard at Sergius Ayer's was white as chalk, the sky a vista of cerulean blue. Even the grief-stricken waters of the River Thames seemed to sparkle, reflecting back the purity of that sky, and if ever there was a reason to think this summer a dream, there it was, for Kathy had never known the river anything but turgid and grey. The children had flocked out to watch the Emporium wagons on their way. Ruddy faces watched from the rails, holding to last Christmas's treasures, backward bears, Martian rockets, more wind-up soldiery than a boy could ever find uses for. In the street beyond, a motor car drew around. Casper Godman, black hair rippling behind, rose to the tips of his toes, threw the boys a flurry of salutes and drove on. Trips out of the Emporium were far and few between, but Kathy relished each one. Winters had always passed in the same controlled chaos as she had known since she arrived at the Emporium, but summers could be stultifying. Too much time in the shadowed aisles was not good for the soul, no matter what Emil said. A turn through the summer sun was the restorative Kathy needed, and a trip to Sergius Ayer's always renewed her faith in what the Emporium was for. Casper was about to steer into the controlled pandemonium of Regent Street when Kathy clasped his arm, directing his gaze at the girl sitting beside her. 8 years old and the mirror image of her mother, small and dark with darting green eyes, Martha was peering over the side of the motor car, gawking at the great billboards of the Piccadilly Circus as if it was these things, not the wonders of Papa Jack's Emporium, that defied all reason. She wore the same look every time they emerged from the Emporium, constantly finding adventure in the ordinary. "Do we have to go back quite yet?" "What was I thinking?" Caspar gasped in mock surprise. Martha beamed up at him. "A change of heart never hurt a soul," he declared, and bellowing at a horse and trap about to cross their way, he arced the motor car around and sped off along the Broadway. The afternoon was growing old, Hyde Park in full blossom. He drove them up and down the Rotten Row, turned dramatic circles around the Apsley Gate, and finally, when it was growing dark, plunged headlong into the grand parades of Belgravia, where men in tall frock coats, didn't these people know it was summer, and a 20th century summer at that, looked aghast at these deplorables come to ruin the afternoon. One man barked at them to show some respect, and this was a thing that delighted Caspar and Cathy both. They turned to blow kisses, and would have followed through with dainty little waves if only the air had not been suddenly filled with invective. The hollering of a brawl, and next moment the sound of shattering glass. Belgrave Square, an explosion of green among the grand terraces, was drawing people to it like ants to spilled sugar. As it met the crowd, the motor car had to slow to a crawl. Two tradesmen crossed their path with impunity, barely flinching when Caspar ordered them out of his way. One of the men clasped a rock in his fist. Brazenly, he tossed it from one hand to another, then brought his arm back and let it fly. Over heads and the crowns of treetops it flew. It fell short of the house behind the black railings, but the second and third were better thrown. Glass shattered. Somebody sounded an alarm. "Head down, Martha."
"But Mother..."
"Head down, please." From Martha's lap, a patchwork face picked itself up. Sirius had grown a little more ragged with the years. His black button eyes had been ripped off by over-eager hands, stitched on and re-stitched again. His patches were thicker where they had been replaced, and what mechanism still drove him purred a little more incessantly every time he moved his limbs. Martha held on to him, her face screwed up in a scowl. This was the problem with living in the Emporium, thought Cathy. You did not develop an instinct for the real world when all you knew was toys. Martha had no reason to fear, for she had never seen anything like this. But then, so Cathy supposed, neither had she. Two men were scrabbling into the boughs of one of the trees, the better to observe the carnage. "It isn't safe," she whispered. "Caspar, what do you think it is?" "It's the embassy." Sirius was up on his haunches, hackles raised as if to protect Martha. A man crashed alongside the car, brought his arm back and let fly with another rock. More glass shattered in the face of the building above, the volley followed by a dozen and more. By now the motor car had ground to a halt, an island in the sea of men. Caspar tried to halloo one of them, but to no avail. Instead he reached down and grabbed him by the scruff of the neck. "What's happening here?" "See for yourself, mister," a voice barked back. And soon Caspar found an afternoon edition pressed into his hands. Caspar unfurled the rag, while another stream of men, bank clerks and bricklayers, buffeted the wagon to join the crowds on the other side. With a flick of his wrist it rolled down his arm. Three striking words leapt out of the print. "His Majesty defied." Caspar dropped the newspaper into Cathy's lap, where she read on. War begun without formal declaration. A dreadnought sunk by German privateers in the Northern Sea. Heroes recalled from summer holidays in far-flung climes. And there, underneath it all, your country under attack.
"Can I read, Mama?"
In silence, Cathy folded the newspaper and placed it underneath her seat.
"Perhaps we should return home, Mrs. Godman."
Mrs. Godman. Even now it was a novelty to hear it. In the same taunting tone he used to say, "Miss Ray." Home, she thought, and into her head came an explosion of atriums and aisles, the quarters above and workshops deep below, the pack of patchwork dogs over which Sirius ruled, the phoenix that sat at all times in the rafters wherever Papa Jack roamed, and that little Wendy house, hidden now in the paper trees, where it sometimes seemed her very life had begun. Yes, she answered. Home. And put an arm around her daughter as the cacophony faded behind. Come back to the Emporium now. It has changed much since we have been away. 8 years have seen the aisles transformed, but so too the sky above them. The cloud castle that floats, forever churning out the steam on which it survives in the Emporium dome, belongs to Emile. The patchwork Pegasi that gambol around it, those were built by Papa Jack. The paper trees that you must remember have long since put down roots, rucking up the floorboards for aisles around. The secret doors have been unleashed, their entrances and exits finely tethered together, so that now a customer might enter on the shop floor and exit onto a gallery high above. The Midnight Express, Emile's endeavour of 2 summers past, is a miniature locomotive that will ferry customers from the atrium into the new showrooms, bigger on the inside than the out, that Papa Jack has chipped out of the world. There are too many new delights to mention. But let me mention Casper's masks. Put one of these on, and you might find yourself becoming the animal whose likeness you have taken. But some things will never change in this emporium of ours. Casper still cavorts recklessly around. Emile still lines up the soldiers he has diligently made. And Cathy still makes certain their long war does not rise up out of the battlefield into the Emporium aisles. Yes, come back to the Emporium with me now. You have been away too long. The letters arrive before the end of the month. Emile, who was up every morning at dawn to turn his workshop lathe, brought them to Papa Jack's breakfast table where the whole family gathered. Mrs. Horning had served up deviled eggs, but this morning there was not an appetite in the entire emporium. Sirius begged for scraps, but every time Martha sneaked one into his cotton wadding jaws, he turned up his nose, uncertain what to do with things as alien as toast and griddled fish. Douglas Flood, Emile began, reading the first letter aloud. Keezy and Dunmore. They're saying they'll be back by Christmas, that we needn't worry. This thing will be over by first frost, that's what they're being told. But what if it's not? Casper, embroiled in one of his breakfast battles with Martha, would not be drawn on the subject. Cathy saw him pointedly keeping his eyes down. Let's send some more notices into the wild, Papa Jack began. His voice was more feathery than it had been. Emile's rattled like Vickers' gunfire, but Papa Jack remained a whisper. There are always shop hands. Not good ones, not like Douglas and Dunmore, even Robert Keesey. How could we teach a new team to wrangle the rocking horses, or to make more soldiers, or even where everything is? Can you imagine a first-year shop hand teaching one of your unicorns how to walk, let alone the Pegasus foals to fly? By the time we were done, the snowdrops would be up, and there came a knock at the door, and Mrs. Horning reappeared, a telegram in her hands. When Emile tore it open, his face blanched. John Arthur, he swore. John Arthur signed up too. Well? But the faces around the breakfast table bore the news without the panic that had turned Emile's features to a parody. Casper flourished his finger in one direction, drawing Martha's gaze. While she was looking the other way, he snatched an egg from her plate, made it reappear in her pocket, and when she cracked it open, it revealed not gleaming white and vibrant yolk, but a patchwork chick who squawked, waiting to be fed. Emile, is there a time in life when you might not think it's the end? Do you know? Papa Jack lifted a granite hand. Your brother is right to be afraid. I didn't say I was afraid, Papa. If this is truly what they're saying it is, and here Papa Jack brandished the newspaper, then we would do well to watch ourselves. Godman is a name that might pass, not like Schneider or Schmidt, but there can be scarcely a boy in the city he doesn't know us for what we are. That we're not like them. Bring them into our emporium, sit them down with our toys, and they would see that we were all children once,
But, passing in the street or looking up at the shuttered-up shop front with a rock in their hand and a belly full of beer? No, not then. Emil twisted. The Russias are ranged up against the Kaiser, father, just the same as us. A little thing like that oughtn't matter to the man on the street. Given the excuse, a certain sort of man would put a stone through your window if you so much as had a different colour eye. No, I've seen this before. London loves its toymakers from the frozen east. Until it doesn't. Love and hate, they are such very similar things. Kathy had heard quite enough. However much Caspar was trying to distract her, he was using his pencil to draw figures on the tablecloth, and now those figures were dancing, pulling faces, battling each other back. Martha's eyes kept darting to Papa Jack's. When Papa Jack spoke, the world stopped turning on its axis so that it might listen. "Martha, perhaps it's time you cleared the plates away." Martha's face turned to Erictus. "Mother!" "Now, Martha." Caspar could see where this was going. The only time Kathy ever turned brittle was when Martha glared like this. But she had Kathy's pluck, the same pluck that had brought Kathy to the Emporium doors, and that was something that couldn't be quashed. Better that it be diverted instead. Even the wildest rivers could be diverted. "Mademoiselle, shall we?" In moments Caspar was bustling Martha through to the parlour where, together, they would tempt Sirius to lick the crockery clean. After they had gone, Kathy looked between Emil and Papa Jack. "If you must talk of this thing, there are enough locked doors in the Emporium." She stood so that she might look down on them, as if it was they who were her children. "Whatever this is, she's 8 years old." Emil spent the morning in his workshop, scything more soldiers out of wood while his Imperial Capitan watched from on high. It was meant to be cathartic work, but today his hands were separate from his body. They kept slipping so that he planed a soldier's arm down to a stump or opened up his belly to reveal the cavity where the wind-up workings were to slot inside. Finally, he gave up. The Imperial Capitan was still watching, his painted features as proud of Emil's trembling hands as they were when he spirited perfect soldiers out of scraps left on his workshop floor. It was time, Emil decided, to stop. Down on his knees, he ranged up a troop of wind-up soldiery and set them to battle each other. Ordinarily, watching his soldiers lifted him out of himself. But today the feeling was not the same. The battle being fought behind his eyes was too strong. The calendar on the wall, which Emil had inscribed himself, read the 5th of August. There were still 2 months until he would dare stay up each night, searching for signs of first frost. And yet he was thinking about it every day, and had been since the moment the snowdrops flowered on the Emporium Terrace and last season's magic came to an end. That sweet anticipation. Even the anticipation of the anticipation was enough to sustain him through the long, lonely, yes, he used the word at last, summer. He did not mind the endless days with only him and the Imperial Capitan, did not mind listening to the sounds of Caspar and Martha playing in the aisles, nor even of Caspar and Kathy playing through the bedroom walls at night, not when he knew there would come a day when Douglas Flood and Robert Keesey, Dunmore, John Horwood, and all the rest would stream back through the Emporium doors and light the aisles up, play battles in the palace and stay up late with him, concocting all sorts of stories, playing all sorts of games. Emil had long ago observed that he himself was like one of the Emporium's backwoods bears, in hibernation through the summer, only truly alive when winter was at its most fierce. A whole year's life could be lived in the space of an Emporium Christmas. And yet, the thought of a winter without them, his boy so far away while Emil remained alone in the Emporium, well, that was what was clouding his thoughts. That was the reason today's soldiers lay dismembered on the bench, their faces as crude as the ones on sale in all the lesser toy shops of London town. "What do you think, little thing?" he said, eyeing the Imperial Capitan. "I'm going to have to talk to you. If I don't talk to somebody, I'm bound to go mad, and you're the only one there is." The Imperial Capitan eyed him with its unflinching face. "If only you could talk, why, then we'd see." Clasping the Capitan, Emil ventured onto the shop floor. There would be the customers. His days would be filled with showing boys battles or restacking shelves or taking the most brave shoppers on tours of the jungles his father was planting, where all manner of patchwork creatures would frolic in the vines. It wasn't as if there would be no joy. The world would stop turning before there was an Emporium winter without any joy. A noise from above drew his eye. Casper was dangling from one of the galleries where the frame of Emil's cloud castle was tethered. Its towers and portcullis borne up by a reef of churning steam. Moments later, Martha, perched on the balcony beside him and goaded on by Casper, dropped over the edge. Together they released their fingers, and would have plummeted down if only Casper's longships with their dragon-head prows had not appeared underneath. Casper dropped into the first, Martha into the second, and the dragons, opening their jaws in the way Casper had designed, took off as if swimming in the cloud castle's moat. Laughter fell around Emil like a deluge of rain. The longship swooped and turned at the command of their mechanical oarsmen. But what was keeping them afloat, Emil dared not guess. Impressive as his cloud castle was, any engineer with half an interest in atmospherics might have achieved the same thing. But those longships had sailed straight out of Casper's dreams and into the Emporium air. Another voice joined the laughter above, and there was Kathy, at the same balcony rail with Sirius yapping at her side. She had been admonishing them. She always admonished their escapades. But as Casper's dragon boat completed its circle and drew near, something changed. Emil saw her head drop to one side. How beautiful she looked when she disapproved and yet approved at the very same time. Then timing her leap perfectly, she propelled herself over the side. The dragon boat tilted as she hit it. Moments later she and Casper were off, hunting Martha in the mist, the dragon heads showering sparks as the laughter continued to pour down. Yes, the Emporium was a place of joy. But without the shop hands this winter, the joy could never be Emil's. "What would you have me do?" he whispered. But the Imperial Capitan offered no reply. That evening, Martha would not listen to her stories. She asked, "What does it mean, Mama? Is there to be a real war, like the ones Papa and Uncle Emil play? With cavalry charges and a noisy cannonade?" Kathy stroked the hair out of her eyes. "Why'd you say that, my treasure?" "None of the shop hands are coming, are they? They're to fight their real wars. But why do people fight wars, Mama? Why, when there are toy soldiers to do it for them?" "What an Emporium thing to say. Only a girl raised in these isles could think such a thing." And yet, she thought, why not? "Whatever happens, whatever things they do out there in the world, it won't touch us. Not here. Not in our Emporium. What you saw at the embassy, that isn't coming here. You're safe here, my treasure. Safe with your mama." When she reached their own chamber, Casper was already in bed. Kathy ordered Sirius away, off to guard Martha through the long night, and would have sat down herself if only her feet hadn't kept on walking. "I've seen you like this before. You're prowling. Prowling like a caged tiger." "I'm frightened, Casper." This was new. The Kathy Casper had fallen in love with had never admitted such a thing. He lifted himself from the covers. "Whatever happens, whatever things they do out there in the world, that's precisely what I just told Martha. You can't pull the old lines on me, Casper.
We wrote those lines together, remember? Casper said, There's no need to be afraid. But Dunmore and Kesey and little Douglas Flood, off to carry bayonets like it's just another game. If they're gone, how many others? Thousands, I shouldn't wonder. Thousands and thousands and thousands. Casper had said it dreamily. But now he came to his senses. Whatever happens out there, it won't be like the Long War. What sort of madness might that be? To wind up a battalion of living things and march them at one another, as if that might win a war. Casper took her by the hand, drew her down to the bedsheets. If the Emporium's magics would not make her forget the outside world tonight, well, there were other ways. He rolled over her, staring at her dewy-eyed until she could no longer contain her laughter. He looked pointedly absurd when he glared at her like that, and he knew it. You're a fool. War declared, our shop hands gone, panic in the aisles and blood on the streets, and you, all you can think about is this. All the same, it was Kathy who kissed him first. That night, in bed, she had dreamt about blood on the streets. 3 mornings later, there it was. In lurid smears up and down the Emporium doors, a dried-up pool of viscera spreading out onto Iron Duke Mews. Mrs. Hornung was already on her hands and knees, the pail of water at her side frothing with scarlet soap, when Kathy arrived. Kathy had come in search of a letter, for Lizzie wrote often, and her stories were better than anything in the Reader's Digest magazines. But no postman had dared a delivery this morning. A pig's head sat in the middle of the filth, warning strangers away. Mrs. Hornung, don't you mind me, girl, I was here to see it happen. Opened up to flush out the cobwebs when they boulded up the mews. Foreign dogs, they shouted, foreign dogs, as if their mamas and papas hadn't brought them to these same doors every Christmas and spoiled them with Mr. Godman's toys. I tried to reason with them, but those butcher's boys had their buckets and... For the first time, she stopped scrubbing and turned to face Kathy. The pig's blood had made a merry mess of her apron. It ran in the creases of her neck, giving the impression that somebody had come for her with a knife. Let's get you upstairs, Mrs. Hornung. Not a chance, girl, not until this is done. Oh, and if there's blackguards winning. It's like Mr. Godman says. We were all babes once, English and German, and even Spaniards, I should say. Kathy rolled up her sleeves. 2 backs are better than 1, Mrs. Hornung. You move on up, those flagstones are going to need some working. She had not yet broken a sweat, though the work was hard, the blood needing scouring from each stone, when she heard more footsteps thundering up Iron Duke Mews. Instinct told her this was another villain come to daub their Emporium walls, just as they had daubed the fronts of every emigrant bookseller, locksmith and chocolatier since the day war was declared. But when she looked up, an altogether more bewildering sight was coming their way. Emile was hurrying back into the Emporium in great, loping strides. His chest was heaving, his fists were bunched, and though he hopped ungainly through the sea of dried blood, he kept his head steadfastly up, refusing to acknowledge Kathy and Mrs. Hornung on their knees at his feet. "Emile!" Kathy cried out. But in response he contorted past them and was lost in the darkness of the summer aisles. Kathy stared for a long time after he had gone. When was the last time Emile left the Emporium, Mrs. Hornung? More than out here to sign for a tradesman? I should think it's been half that boy's life. Mrs. Hornung had not broken her rhythm. She was still scouring the flagstones into submission. But after that, and though she kept on scrubbing, Kathy's mind was not on the task at hand, nor even on the pig's head that stared at her with such derision. She could still picture Emile's face, seen as if from below. She was not mistaken. Emile had been crying. Emile did not appear when the gong sounded for dinner that night. Martha, whose tutor Mr. Attlee had just departed, leaving her with a composition on the works of Charles Perrault, was the last to the table. After that, Papa Jack recited some words of thanks in that language Kathy still could not understand, and then Mrs. Hornung served up her rich chicken broth. When Emile had still not appeared by the time she wheeled out her suet pudding and plum sauce, Kathy teased Sirius's ears and sent him down to the workshop on the shop floor. Who knew how Emile understood the patchwork?